I'm Bill Teeple. I'm here with Alan Cobb. This is Icon Art Radio, and our special guest, who was here last week, but we just had to have him come back and continue, is Paul Glossop.
Thank you.
Our student of geometry here in Fairfield. And he was explaining sacred geometry, and we were talking about the pursuit of the sacred geometry of square, and this ancient pursuit throughout the history of mankind of squaring the circle. Now, you can continue in any way you want, but you mentioned something about two kinds of circles.
Well, before we get to that, I just wanted to interject, in case the listener isn't completely clear about what... It sounds like we're talking about doing things, and we are. And the things that we're doing are, in one sense, geometric projects or exercises or challenges, and they're done with a compass and a straight edge. And when we say a straight edge, we don't mean a ruler, because it doesn't have any units of measurement on it. So there's a kind of purity to this that isn't there when you start measuring things, which is more where science comes in. What we're talking about, for example, is I give you a compass and a straight edge, and I ask you to draw me a square. And there are various ways you can do that, but you can't just measure off 4 inches and then somehow gauge 90 degrees from that and measure off another 4 inches, because there's nothing to measure with except the compass. And getting the angles has to be done by constructing geometric truths rather than by reading something off of a scale on a protractor. So that's a simple but very profound example of a geometric construction. And we ended the last show talking about the four squares that are found when you begin to contemplate a circle. The square that contains the circle, the square that just fits inside the circle, the square whose circumference is the same as the circle, and the square whose contained area is the same as the circle. And that struck me in a sort of poetic sense as being a bit like the right hemisphere, the artist side of the brain, if you will, looking at the circle and seeing in the mind's eye a square that just contains it and a square that just fits inside of it. And then the other two are more conceptual squares, which the left hemisphere, the more analytic side of the brain, is interested in. And this, so in this simple set of geometric constructions, we have something that really represents the two ways that we all have of looking at the world. And if we're made in God's image, then there's something rather profound about that.
I look at those two more conceptual squares, as you call them, as departure points for more subtle applications of sacred geometry, such as the construction of altars. Now, it's a whole area that I haven't looked into and I don't know about very little. But if you go back in history, way, way back, There's a very important section of all religions which had to do with sacrifice. And in this case, sacrificing your time and attention at an altar, mm-hmm. With certain chanting, certain scriptures, certain mantras of scriptures being chanted in a very exact way, and the altar itself being very exact. So I look at those center circles, which when I draw them in a diagram, I usually draw them pink for devotion, mm-hmm. or for feeling, as a departure point for a different branch of sacred geometry than the two that are far more physical and far more obvious that, mm-hmm. that bracket them. I think of those two as the heart of sacred geometry, and I think of them as actually pulsing. And that pulse fits in very nicely with the mathematical fact that you can never according to the rules that Alan spoke of just a little earlier, you can never construct those two pink squares, those two interior squares, those two heart squares cannot be constructed perfectly using the straight edge and the pair of compasses. And that's the joy of the mathematician who in 1885 said, you can't do it. And it was at that point that squaring the circle pretty much came defunct. And I've said, it's very important that you can't do it, because those interior squares are pulsing with life. There are as many different ways to get close to an answer, but you'll never get the exact answer. And if a heart is not pulsing, the body is dead. And so you want the heart to be moving in and out. The heart of this particular problem is always a moving target, and it's always a holy grail, or it used to be a holy grail for early mathematicians.
And there's no perfection in the relative.
Yes.
And it's altogether fitting and proper that there should be none.
Absolutely. Except that there are the body squares.
Yes. Which
are much more definable and can be so-called.
They can be constructed, right?
They can be constructed. Yeah. And yes, and coming back to Alan's point, how do you construct a square? It's actually not... it's not insignificant. Presuming that you start with a circle, which is the usual way to do sacred geometry, there are six more circles required to get the four corners of the square exact. And there's a couple of different ways of doing it, but usually it's done with these six ways. And that gets you the circle, the square that lies outside the circle, just touching it. And then from there, you can draw two diagonals. They intersect the circumference of the square, and you can easily draw the interior one. And those two squares, in my opinion, are the departure point for all the more manifest aspect of sacred geometry, which has to do with the jewelry that's in front of us, the architecture of cathedrals, say. And in fact, if you do go back into history and you read very carefully, you'll find that at least all the European cathedrals, the first stroke that was put down on the design, I won't call it paper because it was probably some kind of, some different medium, but we'll call it paper. So you drew the circle. The geometers of that time were highly religious people. And they said, the circle is of God. If we start drawing our cathedral with a circle, which indeed is usually never incorporated in the final architecture, but is the invisible starting point, and if we develop the geometry from the circle, then because the circle is perfect, because the circle is of God, then the cathedral will always be a protected place and within the precinct of the cathedral. So there are theses out there that show how various cathedrals, particularly Peterborough Cathedral in England, was developed from the circle, and that probably all others were, and that it was a fairly secret practice too. And you asked a question right at the beginning about what I call the two different kinds of circle.
Yes.
There's... everybody knows when they look at a circle on paper, if you look at it with a magnifying glass, the line of the circle has a thickness. And the closer you look at it, the rougher it is. Now, the ideal circle represented in pure mathematics is infinitely thin, and you cannot see it. So what good is that circle for something that's going to be practical? The abstracted from the ideal circle is this what we might call a rough circle. To you, to anybody's glance, it's a perfect circle. But it still has a thickness and a roughness. Now, that roughness is fairly refined roughness, but it's one of the two types of circle. They could both be the same, mathematically speaking. But in consideration of the roughness of the circle, we must say that sacred geometry is that which appeals to the eye. Now, when the eye looks at any examples of sacred geometry, It has a tolerance, a breadth. It has a heart behind the eye, as it were, that says, oh, that's definitely a circle divided into seven, and it looks pretty good to me. Well, that's definitely a square. Whereas if the scientist went up and measured it and found a tenth of an inch difference, he'd say, aha, I told you so, it's not a perfect square, it's not a perfect circle, it's not perfectly divided. But the eye, which is the key input of human physiology, has this tolerance and allowance to make perfect something.
But that the eye, the soul, knows the other circle, right? The soul is perceiving the other circle, and the rough platonic one is approximating what is already perfect within the soul of the viewer, which appeals to me because we use this all the time.
The imperfect circle evokes the perfect circle.
Well, some people say, as you're saying, that the archetypes live inside the human psyche somewhere, and that without those archetypes, we would not see. We would simply...
Right.
There would be no square. Yeah. There would be no circle.
Right.
If you're metaphysically inclined, you hear a lot of things about, at one end of the scale, unity, oneness, singularity, wholeness. And mathematically, we could sort of, I'm saying, align that with the number one. But all those characteristics that are align with the number one also align with infinity, because you have infinity being all-embracing at one end, and you have oneness being all-embracing at the other end. Not even to talk about zero. For another time.
Which is a circle.
Which is a circle. But but in between one and infinity, you have some impossibilities from a metaphysical point of view, which is two or three or four or five. Metaphysically, philosophically speaking, they are impossible. And yet, those numbers are what makes the possibility for us to live in this world. And the low numbers were so revered by the ancients that they were given names like the monad, the dyad, the triad, the tetrad. The one for the seven is the heptad. And just a little short of being gods in the ancient way of thinking. So there was this consciousness that flowed through whole number. So sacred geometry, when it expresses in through, say, architecture or art, the exact number two or the exact number, the whole number three or four or five or six, is expressing something paradoxical, something impossible, because it's not wholeness. It's two-ness, it's three-ness, it's four-ness. And therefore, it's highly revered. But now, it's just a number in mathematics, mathematicians.
But because we don't talk about the inside value of these things. We only talk about the surface level of these things.
Yes.
And that's why we call Maya that which is not. Isn't that right? Because you're saying it's impossible, that it doesn't, we can't have creation, and yet that's what the Maya is nothing but that, and that's our world.
Well, and from another, I mean, to me, you've just described in completely different language the notion that I play with a lot, which is that by virtue of separating the subject from the object, the process of manifestation or the process of perception is required, and it is in fact that initial separation into two-ness out of oneness that gives rise to everything. And it's simply because you have, and I mean, even just in a purely mathematical domain, you can say that duality gives rise to hierarchy. Because with two things, You have the individual things and you have the two together as a system. So you have the whole, which is greater than the sum of its parts. And if you have the system, then you have the system and one of the parts, or the system and the other parts, that's two more systems. And then you have those three systems, and those three systems along with one of the systems by itself. And just out of pure thought, without anything real involved, you end up with an infinity of diversity. And it comes out of nowhere, simply as a consequence of escaping unity. And if that isn't abstract enough for you, I don't think I can go any farther.
Well, for those who have just tuned in, we're out there. This is Icon Art Radio, woo-hoo, and we're interviewing Alan Cobb, and me, Bill Teeple, are interviewing Paul Glossop, a student of geometry, sacred geometry.
Now, Bill, just before the show started, there was something that you said very interesting about curves and straight lines.
Well, we were talking about squaring the circle, and you said every straight line refers to the square and every curved line refers to the circle.
That's right.
Which made me think of how I teach a more esoteric understanding of drawing to those who care. And I talk about that we have the blank, unbounded space. And when you're staring at this paper, you are staring at your unbounded consciousness. It's not a piece of paper. It creates the arena for consciousness to do something. And then as soon as we make the dot, we've created that point out of which a creation emerges. And you have your choice then at that point. Well, then we move the dot and create a line. Now, that line can be curved or it can be straight. In other words, it could refer to the circle or it could refer to the square. Yep. And I was saying how once we've made that choice of moving, we're going to see this like choice move forward as intelligence moves through the entire of art history as the choice towards towards structure or dynamism. For structure, which means creating a structure, or the dynamism, which is that quest for ecstasy or the quest for expansion beyond structure. And so one is the romantic side of, one is the classical or the romantic impulses in art. One is for structure and one is for dynamism or consciousness itself or life itself flowing in that structure.
Is the structure the straight line?
The structure is the straight line and the dynamism is the curve. So we're relating everything we've been talking to today to my world of art.
I found in very practical terms, actually, that now for the last 4 or 5 or 6 years, I've been drawing diagrams. Now, there's wonderful computer programs out there that will do all the trigonometry for you. And in case you've forgotten what trigonometry is, it's the mathematics that allows you to calculate the geometry. But now the computer will do the trigonometry for you. So if in the old days, before computers, you had to calculate trigonometry, it would take you weeks. Now it does it in seconds. So you can have the joy of experimenting with geometrical structures, geometrical figures, geometrical constructions. And so I've spent many, many hours doing that and have found that when you marry the square and the circle, and this is even just considering the square that lies outside the circle, it gives rise to many interesting geometrical constructions and many answers to classical questions. There were two more classical, oh, actually maybe three more classical questions that went along with squaring the circle that are very famous. The other one is what's called doubling the cube. And that means constructing a cube that's double in volume to a given cube. There's a third one called trisecting the angle, which from a pure mathematical point of view is impossible, the same as doubling the cube, using straight edge and compasses alone. And sometimes to those three classical Greek problems were added, dividing the circle into various whole numbers. Now, it so happens that the proof of the pudding is in the eating. If we're saying that sacred geometry lies between the extent of the square and the circle, when there's nothing straighter than a straight line and nothing more curved than a circle, then if you put the two of them together, they should give birth to some answers. And for those of you, you know, we can't do this on the radio, but for instance, I have here a very simple way of dividing the circle into seven. It isn't seen in any of the textbooks, but after the square and the circle are drawn, it just takes about three strokes, and you get this pink angle here, which is 1/7 of the circle. And it's accurate to about 7 parts in a million, which is entirely satisfactory. Of course, the mathematicians have gone out of their way to prove that it's not possible to divide the circle into seven. However, if you can get an answer that's that close, then you're doing something that satisfies the eye, and it comes back into the eye, and then the brain says, ah, yes, dividing the circle into the virgin number, seven.
And all you need to do that is to allow your lines to have thickness.
Yes, that's right, because the accuracy is hidden within the thickness of any of those lines. Yeah. Those lines are only 1/500th of the, you know, they're very thick.
Yeah.
So one question, we could go on and on. I just find this utterly fascinating. I don't know how much time we've got left, but before we run out of time, I want to ask you about the golden section and the Fibonacci series and that relationship where the part, where is it? You divide a line where the smaller part is to the larger part as the larger part is to the whole, which I find to be a very fascinating relationship. Does your mind go into the, I mean, what do you have to say about the golden section?
Okay, the golden section is, let's say it's very popular.
Okay.
And
it's totally popular. That's all you ever hear about.
You ever hear. Actually, tons of books have been written on it. A lot of them say the same thing. A lot of them quote each other. And a lot of them seek to find the golden section in ancient architecture because they think, well, it's a really brilliant geometrical construction or geometrical reality. Surely the Greeks had it or the Romans had it. I'm of the opinion that the golden section wasn't that well exercised into architecture. Now, the golden section, to get a little bit technical, is 1.618 to 1. So if you imagine a rectangle that's 1.618 feet on one side and 1 foot on the other, you have a golden rectangle. However, more frequently we find in Roman and Greek architecture that the square root of 2 was used. So 1 to the square root of 2 is, I think, 1 to 1.41. And yes, the golden number appears in nature, but it appears in nautilus shells, and it appears in the development of the seeds of a sunflower plant and quite a handful of other places.
Isn't it the triangle in the pentagon, isn't the base the golden
relationship? Oh, yes, the pentagon. The pentagon and the pentacle within the pentagon.
Pentacle, yeah.
The pentacle is the star that's made out of the pentagon. Is riddled with the golden number. Every ratio in there is the golden number. And if anybody doesn't know exactly what the golden number is, if you take, it's a certain rectangle that if you cut a square off that rectangle, you're left with a rectangle that is of the same proportion as the original rectangle. So you keep cutting squares off, making smaller and smaller remainder rectangles, and each of the remainder rectangles has the same proportion as the original. On the other hand, no, I'm not going to go into that because it's a...
another show.
Another show.
Yeah, we're down to 2.5 minutes.
Heck, yeah. It's also fascinating. And I know that the Renaissance paintings were all constructed, the underlying geometric structures behind the realistic paintings was all worked out mathematically. I don't even know exactly what all was going on there, but they were obsessed with this stuff.
I want to mention a very little known. Earlier on, I mentioned the tools of sacred geometry, and that there was a certain tool to divide line segments into any number of equal smaller segments, and other tools to divide the circles. Well, the particular tool that divides line segments is known, it was rediscovered by a geometer, a Danish geometer called Tons Bruns. And the people who know about it call it the Bruns Star. And it's an incredible piece of simple geometry that can divide the square up into 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, any number. And it can make the grids that form the basis of the Indian style of architecture called the Vastu Purusha Mandalas. So everybody should know this Tons Bruns Star and learn it in school, because it's not in the textbooks. And yet it's a very basic tool, and it's probably, until Tons Bruns rediscovered it, a secret tool.
I'd like to just wrap up this show, which I wish we could do four more of them right now, by reading a few of the titles, and I'll probably have to fade this out as the show moves on into the theme song, but this is a stack of books that Paul brought as inspiration. The Old Way of Seeing, The Lost Keys of Freemasonry, The Secrets of Masonic Washington, The Secrets of Solomon's Temple, The Dimensions of Paradise, At the Center of the World, The Great Pyramid Decoded, A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe, The Sacred Center, Aesthetics of Built Form.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.